asks the announcer in each spot. There's one way to find out. Another Hardee's ad for the Thick Burger was set to Foghat's rhythmic Slow Ride and featured model Cameron Richardson writhing around on top of a bucking mechanical bull while appearing to have oral sex with an oversized cheeseburger. The announcer says, "We could have shown you some cowboy sitting around a campfire eating the new Western Bacon Thick Burger, but then, who'd want to see that?" Writing for the online journal Slate, reviewer Seth Stevenson suggested, "I guess if the Thick Burger qualifies as food porn, the Monster Thick Burger is XXX hardcore food porn, with cheese bondage and underage buns and deviant bacon orgies." The ad game is all about selling perceptions. Perceptions of sex, perceptions of products. In most cases, sex is merely juxtaposed with the product, the tacit message being, buy our product, get laid. From cheeseburgers to razors to cars, simple juxtaposition does the trick. Britney Spears' new perfume, Curious, is marketed by selling her as a sex symbol. Commercials show Spears checking into a hotel, exchanging glances with a guy checking into the adjoining room. The Dallas Morning News details what happens next. They share a wild, pant-pant fantasy as they stand on either side of the wall, straining to hear and feel each other. Just when you think Britney can't get any classier, she figures out a way. In some of these cases, perceptions of sex are sold plainly, without any mention of product save a company logo. Joe's Jeans, for example, shows the naked female body in many of its ads, accompanied only by their brand. That's the idea behind the Victoria's Secret advertising strategy as well. Sell the models, sell the brand. Yes, they're wearing the lingerie, but who's really looking at that? The Victoria's Secret $10 million fashion extravaganza, TV's Sexiest Night, is all about using attractive models to drop jaws and open wallets. Scalpers were selling 2003 show tickets for upwards of $10,000. The buyers certainly weren't paying all that money to see a few sets of bras and panties. In other cases, products are sold by equating use of the product with the joys of sex. In the movie When Harry Met Sally, Meg Ryan fakes an orgasm while eating at a restaurant with Billy Crystal. "I'll have what she's having," a female onlooker tells her waitress. Ads have been copying the movie ever since, selling products through blatant allusion to orgasm. Herbal Essences promotes its shampoo in commercials depicting beautiful women showering and washing their hair until, shrieking, they reach orgasm. In one of their newer orgy-style commercials, Streaking Party, a large group of men and women streak their hair while dressed in towels and robes. On their website, Herbal Essences instructs customers how to hold their own streaking parties. Helpful tips include, let your imagination run wild. Dare to go bare. Think bikinis, halter tops, sarongs, and terry cloth robes. Give out naughty bags. And satisfy your inner cravings. This is innuendo taken to a whole new level. Herbal Essences spokeswoman Anitra Marsh explains that the original Totally Organic Experience ad set a new bar for advertisements and pushed the envelope at the time, but in a way that stayed true to the product itself. The product is really about the experience. I'm not sure that washing your hair classifies as an experience. If it does, are you promiscuous for using Head and Shoulders some days and Herbal Essences others? Miller Lite's infamous catfight ad campaign, which ran during the 2003 NFL playoffs, played on male fantasies about lesbians, depicting two very well-endowed, attractive women, one of them a Playboy girl, sitting at a coffee shop discussing the relative merits of Miller Lite. "Doesn't Miller Lite taste great?" the blonde bombshell asks her brunette friend. "Yeah," the brunette responds, "but I drink it because it's less filling." They begin screaming at each other, "Great taste, less filling." After pushing over the table, they begin clawing at each other. They end up stripping down to their lingerie and catfighting in a pool, and then in a vat of mud. The commercial then cuts to a bar where one guy tells another, "Now that would make a great commercial." The other guy responds, "Yeah, who wouldn't want to watch that?" The camera then pans to their girlfriends, who are not amused. The pitch for Miller Lite ensues. In the uncut version, one of the guys then says, "I've got an idea for the ending." Cut back to the two mud-covered women, one of whom turns to the other and says, "Let's make out." The commercial ends with them swapping lesbian spit. Apparently, men are so ridiculously stupid that basic juxtaposition of lesbian sex and beer is enough to sell the product. "That's the joke," said Miller Company spokeswoman Molly Riley. "We're making a little bit of fun of it." Oh. Too bad that according to Riley, 30% of the people who saw the commercial were under 21. Coors did its own version of the Sapphic Cell during the same playoff season. Their commercial, Love Songs, featured a montage of different things guys like, including several shots of two good-looking blonde sisters making eyes at the camera. As Sherry Waxman of Salon.com wrote, "Besides being just plain hot, the aesthetically gifted 26-year-old blondes featured in the campaign are twin sisters. Twin sisters whose four blue eyes seem always to be saying, 'Hey boys, anyone up for a three-way?' Sisters in a three-way. Gross." Coors ad company, Footcone and Belding, Chicago, doesn't see it that way. Nobody would argue men love women, so why not two of them? That's why twins rings so true. Hilary Chura, a reporter for Advertising Age, stated that the Coors spot worked wonders. Previously, the brand appealed to women and older men, and the problem with that is that they don't drink as much as 20-something guys. The commercials were so popular that they spawned a series of ESPN SportsCenter imitations, with new screaming lyrics each week, and cheerleaders as the twins. The twins' ads were the highest-scoring spots in Coors history, according to the fortuitously named Ron Askew, marketing chief for Coors. Askew defended his use of the twins as sex objects, claiming that they were actually leaders, not followers. "The women are in control. They're the ones inviting you into the party at 4 a.m. That logic seems a bit askew. It would mean that prostitutes are not sex objects, since they are usually the ones inviting Johns into entanglements. Unintended consequences. The focus on sex in advertising shapes cultural beliefs about beauty and gender to increasing levels among the porn generation. 50 years ago, the emaciated waifs who resemble 12-year-old boys more than women would never have populated our billboards and our television screens to such an extent. Now, young girls are dieting in order to look like them. Barry Gunter of the University of Sheffield states, "Idealized body images in advertising may contribute to lower levels of self-esteem, especially in relation to their own body shape, among some individuals. These effects most commonly occur among young women. A number of experimental studies have indicated that exposure to advertisements containing images of alluring models with slim physiques can result in lowered body self-esteem and greater overestimation of own body size and weight, especially among young women. According to the International Journal of Eating Disorders, by fourth grade, an incredible 80% of American girls have been or are currently on a diet. 40% of 6-year-old girls wished they were thinner, and half will have tried dieting by age 8. According to another study, 53% of American girls dislike their bodies by age 13. That figure rises to 78% by age 17. Joan Brumberg, author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, elaborates, "Although elevated body angst is a great boost to corporate profits, it saps the creativity of girls and threatens their mental and physical health. The objectified image of women in advertising damages girls on an emotional level as well. The women in these ads are sexy, risque, and often quite aggressive. Oversexed advertising is not likely to benefit normal girls. If guys can get their rocks off just by watching a Guess ad, how can the normal girl compete? The only way to compete is to imitate. The liberated woman model encourages girls to show off for the benefit of their male counterparts, all in the name of equality. Meanwhile, men who used to be considered effeminate are the new standard bearers for male beauty. Shaved pecs, toned abs, and bleached hair are all the rage in the age of the metrosexual. It was Calvin Klein who initially set the trend with his underwear ads. Soon, everyone had jumped aboard. Soloflex, the exercise equipment company, put out ads with a female hand reaching out to touch muscular athletes. The caption read, "A hard man is good to find." Jerry Wilson, founder of Soloflex, explained, "There's no way I can sell the product without selling sex." Tom Shales of the Washington Post noted the new manly image. "It's a pecs and biceps world now." Gay sex advice columnist Dan Savage was more blunt. "That our culture is now thoroughly dominated by gay men is not some paranoid Christian conservative's fantasy, but a fact of life." Queer Eye for the Straight Guy confirmed something everyone already knows. Outside of rap and hip-hop culture, stylish gay men are the only tastemakers. And gay men weren't content to just setting tastes in jackets and hair products and cowhide accent chairs. Hardly. We were, however subtly, setting sexual tastes as well. Out went the virile man. So long, Burt Reynolds. And in came the vulnerable boy. Hello, Ashton Kutcher. Men are market-oriented, and they want to provide what women want. So they allowed the gay ideal to become the reality by buying into it wholesale. The image sold by advertising becomes the goal for men and women, but the reality doesn't live up to the fantasy. Constant pornography doesn't equate to happiness or even sex appeal. Ultimately, this coarseness translates to boredom. A 1999 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that sexual dysfunction affected 43% of women and 31% of men. Over 25% of women 18 to 29 said they didn't find sex pleasurable, and younger women 18 to 31 were more likely to have sexual problems than older women. More sexual visibility hasn't made people more happy. It's made them more critical of themselves, more unfulfilled, more unhappy. When our culture transforms a beautiful act between man and woman into a public act catering to individuals, you undermine the fundamental value of sex. Debbie Does Billboards. Paris Hilton is famous for one reason, and one reason only. She's a fabulously rich slut. Hilton starred in the sex tape scene around the world with her then-boyfriend Rick Solomon. She was 19 at the time, while Solomon was 30. At least 9 other sex tapes were said to be in existence as well, including a lesbian sex tape with Playboy playmate Nicole Lenz. The sexually uninhibited Hilton became a target for Larry Flint of Hustler fame, who released pictures of Hilton sharing some lesbian tongue at a nightclub. As Conan O'Brien observed, "Hustler magazine announced that it will feature photos of Paris Hilton making out with another woman, while the woman fondles Paris's breasts." So the search continues for a photo of Paris Hilton not having sex. Hilton has parlayed her tramp reputation into a number of major advertising gigs. She was chosen as the Guess Jeans Girl for Guess Incorporated's 2004 Sexy Fall ad campaign. Although Hilton is bonier than past Guess Girls, according to the New York Observer, her bad girl image jibes with the clothing company's porn light ad campaigns. The ads helped prompt a 13.6% same-store sales jump in September 2004. Unfortunately for her, she was actually dumped from a planned Burger King ad campaign over her porny past. Professional porn star Jenna Jameson has made an advertising mark of her own. Jameson, who will quite literally sleep with anything that moves, posed for a billboard in Times Square in New York, promoting her website, clubjenna.com, and her filmmaker's site, vivid.com, both hardcore porn sites. Jameson stands in a mesh top covering her nipples with her hands. The caption reads, "Who says they cleaned up Times Square?" Vivid.com advertises on billboards along the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles as well. One ad shows several of Vivid's porn stars with the caption, "Look, we can even erect a billboard." Jameson has her own billboard on Sunset Boulevard for her lesbian porn flick, Crystal Method. Aside from advertising her own porn videos and pictures, Jameson also represents the face of Pony Sneakers, which placed her on billboards across America, as well as in the pages of Vanity Fair and Vibe magazines. She does ads for Jackson Guitars as well. Come Chantrell, yes, that's her actual name, vice president and general manager for Pony at the firm, elucidated the attraction of porn in advertising. When I grew up in the 80s in Paris, models were the ultimate feminine ideal. For the 20-year-old kid, porn stars have kind of replaced what models used to represent. Youngsters across the country are catching on to the porn as pop culture wave. Porn star t-shirts for young girls are flying off shelves. Porn star stickers now adorn skateboards and backpacks across the nation. And that's aside from the millions of dollars in products these whores are pushing. We shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that the porn community doesn't understand what's happening. Adult Video News editor-in-chief Tim Connolly touts the new cross-generational marketing, averring, "There's been a glamorization, coupled with a relaxation of society's mores. It's permeating the culture now, particularly with young people. There's a whole new generation that's grown up with MTV and video porn, and girls cavorting around with musicians." Buying into a fantasy. Today, consumers don't buy products, they buy brands. They buy a lifestyle that they can wear, says Nancy Haley, co-founder and CEO of Tehama, a clothing company. According to the National Catholic Reporter, advertising guru Leo Burnett's philosophy of advertising is, people no longer buy products, they buy lifestyles. His clients included McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Nintendo. And there is no easier lifestyle to sell than a sexy one. All these sexual images aren't intended to sell us on sex. They are intended to sell us on shopping, writes Jean Kilborn. The desire they want to inculcate is not for orgasm, but for more gizmos. This is the intent of the advertisers. But an unintended consequence is the effect these images have on real sexual desire and real lives. The wreckage that ensues when people try to emulate the kind of sexuality glorified in the ads and the popular culture is everywhere, from my house to the White House. And many who choose not to act on these impulsive sexual mandates nonetheless end up worrying that something is wrong with them, with their flawed and ordinary and all too human relationships. We live in a consumer culture. Advertising caters to what we want. As human beings, we want sex. It's as simple as that. But by taking advantage of sex to sell us products, advertising demeans sex to the level of any other basic physical activity. It removes sex from the realm of the spiritual or the valuable. Advertisers prostitute themselves for our money, and as consumers, we play the part of the willing Johns. At a certain point, it's difficult to morally differentiate between paying for sex on the street and buying a pair of jeans. The commercials have guaranteed you that in return for your purchase, you'll receive sexual attention. And that should be our goal, shouldn't it? Chapter 8. TV versus virginity. The people were cool. I wanted to try what they were doing on the show. 13-year-old Manhattan boy. We've been called the MTV generation. Considering that MTV claims that 73% of boys and 78% of girls aged 12 to 19 watch their programming, it's an accurate name. A 2000 poll of college seniors at the top 55 U.S. universities showed that while only 23% could name James Madison as the father of the Constitution, 99% knew who the MTV cartoon characters Beavis and Butthead were. MTV sets standards in dress and in behavior, and even in thought. When Beavis and Butthead were at their peak in the 1990s, Beavis's snorting laugh was imitated ad infinitum, an absurdum, at junior high schools around the country. The show, which primarily consisted of two teenage idiots blowing snot into their sodas and lighting pets on fire, among other inane activities, became a cultural icon. Why was it popular? Because these primitively drawn, head-banging, acne-ridden morons were representatives of an increasingly aimless generation. Beavis and Butthead are regressive and proud of it. Mindless role models for lethargic teens who don't want the bother of growing up, writes John Little of The Independent, UK. If Beavis and Butthead were losers with nothing better to do than sniff paint and torture frogs, what kind of losers did that make their viewers? The Beavis and Butthead audience was the constituency of the degraded, and Beavis and Butthead were their elected representatives. Even years after Beavis and Butthead went off the air, they remain representative of typical MTV programming. Vulgar, stupid, repulsive. MTV is morally relativist in every conceivable way. Even aside from its music videos, MTV's programming is oversexed cultural excrement, targeted at kids. As media critic L. Brent Bozell states, it's still the Temptation Channel, a 24-hour hangout selling easy sex, swagger, and swearing, all aimed directly and deliberately at children. The Parents Television Council, run by Bozell, conducted a study of MTV during the channel's Spring Break Raunch Fest. They found that in 171 hours of programming, there were 1,548 sexual scenes containing 3,056 depictions of sexual dancing, gesturing, or various forms of nudity, and another 2,881 verbal sexual references. That averages out to about 18 physical and 17 verbal references to sex per hour. One of the shows that has a specifically sexual focus is The Real World, the famed reality TV show with a simple premise. Throw together a group of young adults, put them in a big city, and watch the raunch develop. MTV bills the show this way. This is the true story of seven strangers picked to live in a house and have their lives taped, and find out what happens when people stop being polite and start getting real. The show is cast for sex appeal, chemistry, and more sex appeal. Applicants are asked questions like, how do you feel about cheating? And, what did you do last night? Pick an episode at random from the most recent season of The Real World, any episode, and you're guaranteed several instances of softcore porn, or worse. For example, The Real World Philadelphia Episode 20, Romantic Getaway, featured two of the female roommates, Shavonda and Sarah, losing their tops on the beach. Shavonda oiling male roommate Landon's nice ass. Shavonda and Sarah French kissing each other during a game of Truth or Dare. Landon losing his shorts during Truth or Dare. Sarah asking male roommate Karamo how many inches he is. Shavonda making out with Landon on a bed. Shavonda and Landon going to bed together. The show's producers arrange for the cast members to be surrounded by alcohol constantly to encourage hookups. In The Real World Las Vegas, both a bar and a hot tub were purposefully placed in the living room. And the casting directors do their job well. Real world housemates have no shame. And the few who react uncomfortably to the constant sexual activity are denounced as prudes or puritans. MTV's goal is to get everyone laid. That's the stated premise behind their show, Wanna Come In? Two geeks bump greasy heads with one another to win money for a hot date with two beautiful girls, the MTV.com website eagerly explains. Wanna Come In is the new show where nerds sweat through several challenges in an effort to get invited up to a babe's pad. The geeks are not alone, though. They'll each have their own personal stud coach to help them hear those coveted words, Wanna Come In? After all, geeks need some lovin' too. There's nothing transcendent about the MTV mindset, but why should there be, when their audience scorns transcendence in favor of materialism and physicality? MTV covers the physicality angle with The Real World & Co., and they push materialism in several of their other series, like Pimp My Ride, My Super Sweet 16, and MTV Cribs. In Pimp My Ride, the eminently talented exhibit, Pimp Master of Ceremonies himself, makes over ugly cars. MTV Cribs centers on the houses of the rich and famous. Don't miss the only show that hooks you up with exclusive insight into your hero's cribs, MTV.com breathlessly exclaims. MTV also glorifies the lives of the wealthy and shallow with shows like Newlyweds, Laguna Beach, The Real Orange County, and Sweet 16. The latter revolves around spoiled 15-year-olds planning their Sweet 16 parties. The show is really a survey in bad parenting. Natalie's birthday wish comes true in the form of a $900 dress and an $800 nail job. Ava's becomes reality when her divorced parents buy her a Road Ranger and a custom-made beige gown that looks as though she is wearing nothing but rhinestones. The most hilarious moment of the episode comes when Ava whines that her mother won't get her the beige dress. "If you stop whining, I'll get it for you," her father shouts. "Way to impose your will there, Dad." Ava makes her grand Sweet 16 entrance being carried by four members of the Loyola polo team, who are cute, sexy, and have good bodies. But the oversexed worldview of MTV doesn't stop at that channel. The same people control MTV2, Comedy Central, TV Land, VH1, Spike TV, and Nickelodeon, among others. Spike TV, the so-called first network for men, panders to the animalistic, ridiculously idiotic side of the male mind with a veritable flood of softcore porn and violence. "We have a phrase here. This channel is PG-25, explains Albie Hecht, Spike's president, a former exec at Nickelodeon and other MTV networks. "It's somewhere between PG-13 and R. We use the word raw a lot around here. The 18 to 34 male is okay with the way life really is. They don't have a problem with words like bull s." In a classic example of defining deviancy down, Hecht calls these viewers the new normal. MTV also controls Nickelodeon, a channel aimed directly at children. Nick's programming has always been more edgy than its kiddie competitors. In the early 1990s, Nickelodeon aired The Ren and Stimpy Show, a gross-out cartoon show that targeted 8 to 12-year-olds. While maintaining its spot on Nickelodeon, Ren and Stimpy became so popular that it eventually found its way to the mothership, MTV, where it aired on Saturday nights. Nick's modern programming is no better, including shows like Zoe 101, starring Britney Spears' little sister Jamie Lynn, Unfabulous, a coming-of-age show starring Julia Roberts' niece Emma, and All That, the preteen answer to Saturday Night Live, former stars of which include Amanda Bynes and Jamie Lynn. Each of the shows is a kid version of something that can be found on Comedy Central or MTV, and each features a kid MTV would like to make into a cultural icon, a la Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera. MTV's network of programming shows us what happens absent any moral grounding. Mired in nihilism, it opens a sex-obsessed world for teens who aren't interested in doing anything productive in their spare time. Killing time has become an aim unto itself. In an age of growing convenience and falling academic standards, there's more and more spare time to be had. And that means more and more time in front of the TV. As of 1999, the average seventh grader watched 4 hours of television per day. This boredom helps explain rapper P. Diddy's ludicrous Vote or Die campaign, pushed heavily by MTV. How else are you going to get through to teenagers who couldn't care less about life, let alone politics? The only way to get their attention is to threaten loss of life. Even nihilists are afraid of death. P. Diddy didn't have to go that far over the top. He could have just threatened the loss of Xboxes and cable access. But somehow, Vote or Go Amish didn't have the same ring to it. Hollywoodites insist that they have to make their programming more edgy, since today's kids are more edgy. In the words of American Pie producer Warren Zeid, "People need to respect the fact that kids are smarter than they get credit for. We like to speak up to kids, rather than down to them. American kids are not smarter than they used to be. They're more jaded than they used to be. Are kids truly smarter because by age 12 they describe themselves as flirtatious, sexy, trendy, cool? Or are they striving to imitate the adult, smart behavior modeled for them by pop culture? The loss of innocence and the rise of jadedness is a direct result of negligent parenting
and immersion of children into an ever-deepening pool of pop culture materialism,
a trend that MTV thrives on. Paying for sex. The only channels more extreme than MTV are the premium cable channels like HBO and Showtime. The shows aired on the pay channels are just as trend-setting among the porn generation as anything on network television. The show that has shaped more young single females than anything else on television is Sex and the City, which aired exclusively on HBO and revolved around the sex lives of four young single women in Manhattan. Carrie Bradshaw, Sarah Jessica Parker, Charlotte York, Kristen Davis, Samantha Jones, Kim Cattrall, and Miranda Hobbs, Cynthia Nixon. These women act like men with regard to sex, willing to sleep with anyone at any time, and the series shows every minute of the steamy sex. They discuss sex with all the panache of a drunken sailor. They obsess over shopping. They glamorize drinking and one-night stands, and they shun all aspects that make femininity attractive, all while whining about the inability to find a nice single man with whom to have a relationship. The glamorization of slut activity is without limit. Over the first 3 years of the series, Samantha has sex with 40 different partners. Here's Miranda on male genitalia. "Women don't care. We care about nice arms, great eyes, big dick. I have never once heard a woman say, 'He had such a big, full scrotum.'" Samantha, on dating strategy. "Wait a minute. You've been dating this guy for 3 weeks and you haven't seen his balls yet? Oh, come on, get with the program." Charlotte and Samantha discuss ejaculation. Charlotte: "My father gave me the most beautiful pearl necklace for my sweet 16. Samantha: "Actually, we're talking about the other kind of pearl necklace. You know, the kind where the guy decorates your neck." It should come as no surprise that Michael Patrick King, the executive producer for Sex and the City, also wrote for Murphy Brown and was a consulting producer for Will and Grace. Predictably, King is a gay lapsed Catholic. King describes the men on the series as the revolving door. "The creators of the show decided to make Miranda a single mother because we thought, okay, what's the worst thing we could do to Miranda?" That's the kind of moral perspective the writers bring to the series. The show is a cultural phenomenon. "We watch it every Sunday night. We have dinner parties," explains Amber Campisi, 21, of Southern Methodist University. "We sit and drink and watch the show. We'll watch the whole DVD of the first season in one day," agrees Siobhan Villanueva, 22, of SMU. "Even if sex this good can't last forever, at least it can be remembered that long." Fashion trends, sexual vocabulary, and dating rules established on Sex and the City soon found their way into mainstream fashion, sex, and dating rituals. Sighs Sarah Portlock of the Washington Square News. The Sex and the City phenomenon has deep societal effects. As Riley Mendoza, a 22-year-old woman from Virginia and one of my classmates at Harvard Law, explained to me, "I really don't like the Sex and the City idea of women thinking of sex like men have thought about it for a long time. Definitely at Harvard, and I think at other colleges as well, there's this idea that feminism is about women being allowed to do whatever they want and being able to act like men. Talk about sex like it's not a big deal. Talk about how to enjoy it. Have one-night stands. It becomes a chatty thing to talk about. I was a part of a female social club at Harvard, and that was the topic du jour, sex. It made people feel empowered, cool. I was not used to that at all, coming from a small town and coming from a family that didn't talk like that at all. I always thought that it was a little hollow, that in the end, women don't think about sex the way that men do, and that people get hurt a lot. But you were supposed to act like you don't care. I think that women biologically do care, and that women can't maintain these no-commitment relationships without getting hurt." Sex and the City has a substantial following among teenage girls with ignorant parents as well. Patty Lewis of Berlin, Vermont, took a Sex and the City bus tour with her teenage daughter Kate, who had seen every episode of the repulsive series. "I love the show," Patty told Meena Thiruvengadam, of the San Antonio Express News. They dare to say and do things that some women just can't say and do, and they make it so funny. Julie Salomon of the New York Times had no problem admitting in her column that her 14-year-old daughter and her girlfriends were found in front of our television giggling happily at Sex and the City in its unexpurgated form on HBO. Perhaps a sign of our licentious times, they didn't flinch when I sat down to join them. But I quickly left anyway, realizing I didn't really want to encounter the show's naughtiest pleasures with my child and her pals next to me. It apparently never occurred to Ms. Salomon that her 14-year-old daughter and her friends shouldn't be encountering the show's naughtiest pleasures at all. And like a case of genital herpes, the show refuses to go away. It was recently picked up for syndication by TBS. HBO subscribers know what they're getting. In June 1998, HBO's top-rated show was the sex documentary Real Sex 19, followed by Real Sex 20, followed by Pimps Up, Hoes Down. HBO's highest-rated series was, of course, Sex and the City. Showtime goes even further. Instead of straight promiscuity, they promote homosexuality. They have to go further than HBO, considering they've been in HBO's shadow for the last 20 years. They promote the Sex and the City imitating lesbian celebrating, the L word, with the tagline, "Same sex, different city," and posters of naked women. Entertainment Weekly describes the Sapphic Love Fest. The L word is a meticulously packaged show. Beautiful women, nifty fashions, slick post-Pottery Barn furniture that makes you say, "Hey, I want to be a hot, successful lesbian living in Los Angeles with trendy friends and a work life that comes in short, dazzling spurts." While the cast maintains that they're doing the lesbian thing to bring tolerance to the world, they're not above pandering to male fantasies. Conventionally, straight men watch lesbian sex, and there's that leering element, but we don't pander to it, insists executive producer-creator Eileen Chaykin. "But it's a sexy show, and if that turns them on, I don't object to it." Of course not. Even those who shill for sexual tolerance aren't above catering to males in their pursuit of ratings. On Showtime, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, so they have a show revolving around male homosexuality as well, Queer as Folk. It's gay propaganda, pure and simple, with the requisite graphic sex. Even Howard Rosenberg, fanatically liberal critic for the Los Angeles Times, describes the show as relentlessly cruising and graphically simulated sex at the expense of character depth, in an assembly line of orgasms ultimately as tedious as it would be if the humpers and thumpers were straight instead of gay. Showtime and HBO maintain that they should be allowed license, considering that they're subscription-based. That ignores the fact that both HBO and Showtime have impacts beyond their immediate viewership. Their shows are promoted in print and on billboards. Their depictions of women and men are culturally accepted. Sarah Jessica Parker of Sex and the City models for Gap. Kristen Davis models for Maybelline. Davis and Cynthia Nixon star in an ad campaign for 7-Up. In the commercial, Pampering, the two actresses lounge around in bathrobes as a male waiter serves them. Davis sees another male waiter coming and says to Nixon, "Looks like our lunch has arrived." Appraising the handsome young man, Nixon quickly responds, "And he brought us grapes." The tagline, "When you add it all up, the only way to go is up." When viewers add it all up, the only way to go is sex. The sitcoms. Last year, the most famous television show of the 1990s came to a close. Friends, which centered around the lives, loves, and sexual encounters of six friends, Rachel, Jennifer Aniston, Phoebe, Lisa Kudrow, Monica, Courtney Cox, Ross, David Schwimmer, Chandler, Matthew Perry, and Joey, Matt LeBlanc. The liberal sexual agenda pervaded the show. Sex had no consequences and was readily available to all. According to one commentator, Rachel had 20 sexual partners over the 10-year life of the sitcom. When the show premiered in 1994, even the socially liberal Daily Variety noted, "Moral and health issues are sidestepped altogether. Friends touts promiscuity and offers liberal samples of an openness that borders on empty-headedness." It's not much of a positive example for Juves, though. Single motherhood was no problem. When Rachel got pregnant by Ross after a one-night stand, there was little public outcry. "I don't think the fans of the show really care that she's pregnant and not married," explained Mary Allen, director and founder of Genesis House, a Melbourne, Florida shelter for homeless pregnant teenagers and women. Even once the baby was born, the writers were careful to ensure that the baby wouldn't slow the action down. Instead, the baby simply disappeared from the screen. The same thing happened with Ross's baby, brought up by Ross's ex-wife and her lesbian lover, as well as Phoebe's surrogate triplets. "Ignoring your kids is so convenient." Homosexuality was glorified. Ross's ex-wife left him for another woman, and Friends became the first primetime show to broadcast a lesbian wedding. Monica chastised Ross for initially opposing the lesbian union, arguing, "They love each other, and they want to celebrate that love with the people that are close to them." Ross later rips into his ex-wife's parents for opposing her lesbianism. And when Ross's ex-wife has his baby, Phoebe explains that having a lesbian couple, an absentee father for parents, is just peachy. "Here's this little baby who has like three whole parents who care about it so much that they're fighting over who gets to love it the most. And it's not even born yet. It's just the luckiest baby in the whole world." As with other sex-filled shows, Friends was immensely popular among the youngest members of the porn generation. Since 2000, Phil Rosenthal of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote, "Friends became exponentially bigger, in nearly every way, when viewed against the changing landscape of network television. A business it helped alter through its success in attracting the young viewers advertisers covet." Ann Savage, associate professor of media arts at Butler University in Indiana, teaches about Friends to her students. "They grew up with it," she says of her students. "They've been watching it since they were kids." The show promoted adolescent attitudes into adulthood for teenagers. Friends took the place of family, and lasting superplatonic relationships were unnecessary. Friends was essentially a 10-year-long sleepaway camp for 20-somethings, where responsibility took a backseat to fun. As Jennifer Fry of the Washington Post characterized it, the show is an homage to endless adolescence, that fantasy world where no one has to grow up, not even when grown-up things happen to them. If Friends was the gold standard for 1990s sitcoms, Will and Grace took the silver, and this show was even more socially liberal than its birth mother. A gay man, Eric McCormick, and a straight woman, Deborah Messing, lived together. The show revolved around both of their dating lives. Sample lines from the first episode of the series. Grace, while lying in bed with her boyfriend: "Are you jealous?" Will, while watching ER: "Honey, I don't need your man, I got George Clooney." Grace: "Sorry, baby, he doesn't bat for your team." Will: "Well, he hasn't seen me pitch." At one point in the show, Will and Grace consider having a baby together. Because after all, what's better for raising a child than a single mother and a gay father? "He's gay, of course, so she'll have to go to the obstetrician to get inseminated with Will's sperm, just like Mom and Pop used to do way back when." It's a tremendous story point, and it is very complicated, obviously, as in real life, Messing explained. "I think it's a very brave and exciting storyline to explore and pursue. In New York, my dearest friends were gay men, so probably the most gratifying part of doing Will and Grace is that for the first time on television, there's a portrayal of a leading male gay character who is three-dimensional, complicated, humane, compassionate, loving, and sensual. That's very important to the gay community, and I was insistent from the very beginning before I would get involved that it be reflective of real life. Propaganda in your living room, brought to you by NBC. And Hollywood won't be policing itself anytime soon. When the Christian Action Network suggested that viewers be warned that Will and Grace contained homosexual content, they were given the cold shoulder. It was an inhumane proposal that should be ignored. According to MPAA President Jack Valenti, and outrageous, according to Norman Lear's People for the American Way. The mere idea that Will and Grace could have been a mainstream hit 20 years ago is absurd, Time reported in December 2004. Polls indicate that about half the population supports some form of gay union, and younger Americans, those under 30, are vastly more accepting of gay marriage, gay adoption, and homosexuality than the population in general. Simply put, while the Bush White House may be on the side of social conservatives, Time is not. The vast majority of the sitcoms on network television today are immersed in sexual innuendo, if not outright vulgarity. Aside from Will and Grace, NBC's primetime lineup includes the Friends spinoff Joey, revolving around the empty-headed, promiscuous actor made famous by Matt LeBlanc. CBS's primetime schedule carries Yes, Dear, Two Married Couples' Frequent Jokes About Sex, Two and a Half Men, Charlie Sheen betting at least 2.5 women per episode, plus a requisite Friends-style lesbian estranged wife, and Still Standing, a former hippie couple talking about their frisky youth, among others. On ABC, Desperate Housewives, glorifying all that is sleazy, is the staple of a schedule that also includes George Lopez, frequent sexual innuendo, and Less Than Perfect. The sex talk rarely stops. WB's big sitcom, What I Like About You, is awash in sexual innuendo. None of these channels can touch Fox for sheer vulgarity, however. Fox's That 70s Show revels in its own jadedness and hedonism, and jokes about marijuana use and casual sex. The Simpsons helped define my generation, and it frequently engages in casual disdain for Christian values. Gay marriage is legalized in Springfield in order to strike a blow for civil rights. Reverend Lovejoy has no idea about the source for the scriptural proscription on homosexuality, and Marge, the good parent, has no problem introducing a lesbian couple to the children. Malcolm in the Middle portrays the insanely chaotic home life of Malcolm, whose parents are very into each other, visiting a porn store for home entertainment purposes, constant sexual references. Family Guy is more jaded, cynical, and vulgar than all the other shows put together. Masturbation, pornography, homosexuality, nothing is off limits. All of this social libertinism takes place in the sitcom context, so there are never any consequences for actions taken, and everything is played for laughs. Making fun of those with traditional values is easy enough. It's always easier to satirize someone with standards than someone without them. There are two reasons for this. First, those with standards are commonly viewed as busybodies by others. External standards that apply to everyone are seen in today's society as overbearing and baroque. That's why sitcom parents are often portrayed as horrifically suppressive and oppressive. Having standards is an old folks thing. Of course, when no one has any standards, or everyone has their own subjective standard, society decays. But that's beside the point. Second, if certain people hold themselves and others to higher standards, it's more common for them to fall short and become the butt of jokes. If Jenna Jameson has adultery, there's nothing to laugh about. If Jerry Falwell does, he'll never hear the end of it. Hypocrisy as humor pushes destruction of standards. But there's a subtext here that's important both for understanding the porn generation and understanding the reluctance of parents to criticize amoral activity. If a character is funny and likable, it makes it tough to condemn his or her behavior. How can you reject premarital sex if your child is partaking in it? How can you condemn homosexuality if your best friend is gay? If you like Jack from Will and Grace, how can you say his homosexuality is sinful? If you like Rachel from Friends, how can you label her sexual exploits wrong? The only danger for sitcoms comes when the laughter stops, when the jokes become stale. Liberal activism isn't quite as funny as it was before. Just ask the producers of Ellen. Angst on Channel 11. The best way to hike ratings is to push boundaries, and television networks know it. Since 1976, the amount of sexual behavior shown during family hour, 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., has increased dramatically. By 1996, most networks didn't set aside the hour as family. Professor Dale Kunkel of the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that 61% of the shows he and his research partners watched during winter 1996 contained sexual behavior, more than doubling the amount visible in 1976. On average, a family hour of network television contained 8.5 references to or depictions of sex, over three times as many as in 1976.
As Leslie Moonves, the president of CBS Television, stated,
"We're competing against Beverly Hills 90210 that has teenage sex every week. My kids know what those kids are doing on 90210. We have stretched the envelope further. Oversexed teen angst dramas continue to make for insanely popular television and particularly dangerous values lessons. 90210 led the trend for the older members of the porn generation, giving them a show containing more sex than Amsterdam's red light district. A prom episode had the high school passing out condoms on the tables. Another episode featured college students agonizing over the difficulties of abstaining from sex for 24 hours. Another contained a college student and her boyfriend trying to have sex in an airplane lavatory. The next episode, the two were at a night spot when the boyfriend asked, 'Want to go to my place and get naked?' 'So much,' the girl responded." 90210 was a cultural phenomenon, garnering 10 million viewers at its inception, and over half of those were teenagers. The latest incarnation of 90210 is Fox's hit show, The O.C. It's a soap opera about Orange County, in reality a particularly conservative part of California. But there's nothing conservative about this version of The O.C. Promiscuity, drugs, and alcohol are commonplace. In fact, they're the driving plot points. This show was designed to retrace the boulevard 90210 tread before. The O.C. has set itself up to head down any number of paths that made its predecessor a camp hit. At its inception in early 2004, The O.C. grabbed an average of 9.6 million viewers. By mid-January 2005, the show was garnering only 6.5 million viewers. To reinvigorate the viewership, the creators did what they always do: push the envelope. This time, they used the tried-and-true shenanigan of the lesbian kiss. Marissa, Misha Barton, the girl next door, discovers that she's in a sapphic romance with Alex, Olivia Wilde, the new in-town barkeep. They end up making out on the beach. Fox got its ratings boost. The January 27th episode that started the lesbian relationship had 8.1 million viewers. When straight sex won't do it for the viewers, going to the forbidden is always a savvy marketing move. Of course, the makers wouldn't be as explicit about their motives as all of that. No, they're opening minds and charting new ground. "Teenagers go through this stuff," Barton told USA Today. "Parents need to accept it or not." Other successful 90210 knockoffs have included Dawson's Creek and One Tree Hill, both of which are based on a deep reservoir of sexuality and have promoted homosexuality to suit their ratings needs. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is essentially 90210 with vampire killing involved and the requisite lesbianism as well. WB's The Gilmore Girls is an ode to single motherhood. Lorelai, the main character of the show, became pregnant at age 16 and is a single mother to Rory. On these shows, virginity is depicted as loser-esque, sex is glorified, and experimentation with the same sex is considered normal.
This conversation between best friends and sometimes lovers Dawson and Joey, female,
from Dawson's Creek, sums it up. Dawson: "I'm the only one who has not had sex. I didn't plan on graduating a virgin. What happened?" Joey: "Best laid plans." Dawson: "This mythical college girlfriend I'm gonna have, will she have sex with me?" Joey: "No, sorry, she's a prude." Dawson: Damn, I had such high hopes The Last American Virgin would fare better as an undergrad. The scene ends with Dawson making out with Joey. This is the witty, horny stuff that goes over as romance on teen television. Teens buy into it big time, and the kids on The O.C. and Buffy and Dawson's Creek and One Tree Hill set trends both sexual and ridiculous. When Seth, a lead character on The O.C., started wearing an old-school members-only jacket on the show, demand for the product among teens skyrocketed. Real-life teens wish they could live like the teens Hollywood promotes. Everyone has sex, and relationships are deep and meaningful, even if they only last a couple episodes. There are never any consequences to any action, except for experiencing the angst of teenage life alongside the characters. When a generation becomes desensitized to the ramifications of the culture around them, it's natural to seek out any sort of feeling, even angst. Uncontrollable. With the proliferation of cable channels, it becomes harder and harder for parents to monitor what is on the tube. Democrat Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts expressed the problem well at a February 1997 congressional hearing. We have moved from the era of Leave It to Beaver to the era of Beavis and Butthead. We have 8 million latchkey children in the United States. We have 18 million single moms. Mom is not home any longer with a peanut butter sandwich and glass of milk for Joey or Susie at noontime. Mom is working now. She's not home in most homes in America. The TV set plays the role of babysitter. That's America of the 1990s. Yet the media hates anyone who does attempt to direct television to a track that is more socially responsible. Anyone who inhibits freedom of porn is an enemy. Especially cultural conservatives like Michael Powell, the former chairman of the FCC. The New York Times editorial board spoke for many other papers when it dragged Powell over the coals after his resignation. Mr. Powell's disappointing reign will be remembered for the extremes to which he went to punish what he called indecency. The broadcasts that were targeted have too often been innocuous, such as the singer Bono's use of a single expletive after he won a Golden Globe Award, and the fines excessive, most notably the $550,000 imposed on Viacom for Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction at last year's Super Bowl. Media companies and artists have complained, with good reason, that the commission's indecency standards are so vague that they are being discouraged from engaging in constitutionally protected speech. Surely, in any other context, the Times would never call a punitive damage award of $550,000 excessive for a corporation that earns billions of dollars a year in profits. Yet obscenity on television is apparently a holy cause at the Times. Powell is hardly the first politician to face such reaction. On May 19, 1992, in San Francisco, Vice President Dan Quayle spoke on the topic of the Los Angeles riots. He discussed the problems of illegitimacy and poverty, and he saved his strongest words for societal glamorization of single motherhood. Bearing babies irresponsibly is simply wrong, he averred. Failing to support children one has fathered is wrong, and we must be unequivocal about this. It doesn't help matters when primetime TV has Murphy Brown, a character who supposedly epitomizes today's intelligent, highly paid professional woman, mocking the importance of fathers by bearing a child alone and calling it another lifestyle choice. The mainstream media immediately jumped on the vice president for his statements about Murphy Brown. It was a tried-and-true conservative tactic. When in doubt, attack the liberals, complained Andrew Rosenthal of the New York Times. It isn't moral values that people laugh at, of course. It's Mr. Quayle himself. And it isn't the elite who do the laughing, sneered Garrison Keillor in the pages of the Times. Eleanor Clift of Newsweek launched into Quayle, snidely commenting, Vice President Dan Quayle went nuts. The 50s fantasy of mom and dad and 2.2 kids went the way of phonograph records and circle pins. It is certain that television alone, or even in combination with magazines and movies, is not to blame for the decline in family values, wrote Kenneth Woodward of Newsweek. Symptom it may be of deeper cultural confusions and contradictions, but as even Quayle must know, it is not the cause. Of course, Quayle never claimed that television was the cause of moral decay. He merely claimed it was a cause. But straw men are easier to knock down than real arguments. The Murphy Brown reference was included because it was a grabby cultural thing that would illustrate the point, Quayle speechwriter Lisa Schiffer told me on February 16th.